What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, oh, we would love to take a crack at that and hopefully help you out with the correct answer, or in other words, what the Church actually teaches. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're listening outside of North America, please dial the U.S. country code and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates, for some folks anyway, may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Charles Beery is our producer. We also have Matt Gubinski on the JOB. He's handling phone screening. Jeff Burson handles social media for us. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook Live, we're streaming there right now. Just all you have to do really is put that question of yours in the comments box. Jeff will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and we will get to it as quickly as we can. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm very well. How are you, sir?
You know, I'm doing decent, thank you.
Going to lead off today with a text, and this is from Connor. Connor says, "My sister is not aware that drunkenness is a sin or can be a sin, but she wants to throw a party for the express purpose of getting drunk to know what it feels like. Now, for certain sins, you must know that what you're doing is wrong in order for it to be a sin. Telling her may not deter her from that, as she isn't a regularly practicing Catholic. So do I tell her that making this act is a sin, or do I not tell her so that she's not culpable? Thanks, Connor."
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the question. So, you know, I would be hesitant to conclude that somebody is invincibly ignorant and therefore, like, they shouldn't be concerned about sin, right? I wouldn't want to make that judgment. Really, God is the only person that can judge whether we're invincibly ignorant or culpably ignorant. And even if a person is invincibly ignorant, so that maybe they haven't sinned mortally before God, the reason things are sins, the reason things are declared to be sins, is that they're not good for us.
Yeah.
They cause some harm to the human person or the human community. And therefore, if I'm ignorant that I'm hurting myself, I'm still hurting myself.
Sure.
And so we have a motive to try to help people live more virtuous, holy lives, not just keep them out of hell, but to keep them out of danger and harm and this sort of thing. So I leave the question of judging culpability up to God,
mm-hmm.
But you can seek the integral good of your sister. And that means trying to keep her sober and trying to keep her friends sober. Now, here's the real difficulty in my judgment. When it comes to admonishing a person who has either done evil or is doing evil or about to do evil, what is the outcome we would like to see? Well, we'd like to see the evil stop.
Yeah.
That's what we'd like to see. And then we have to make a prudential judgment about, is my intervention going to stop it? Or is she just going to toast me at the party?
Yeah.
You know, and the way Catholic moral theologians deal with this is they say, look, here's when you should admonish a sinner. Number one, is something grave. Number two, the person is likely to listen to the admonition.
Mm-hmm.
And number three, you're the best person to make the admonition. Now, if you are fairly confident, we know this is a grave matter, like intending to go out and get El Blotto is a grave matter, right?
Yeah.
If you think that she's likely to listen to you, she will in fact refrain from drunken behavior, and you are the best person to make the admonition, Like, she's most likely to listen to you. There's not somebody else she's more likely to listen to. You come to, then you could make this intervention. Sounds to me like she's pretty much got her mind made up.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I'd be hesitant. Now, if you have knowledge that you maybe, you know, somebody's going to be driving a car, you know, I mean, there may be people putting their lives in danger, other people's lives in danger. You know, maybe a call to the cops would be in order if you think this person's getting ready to get in the car and they can't drive. You know, I'm not saying do that. I'm just raising different possibilities. Might be a number of ways you might be able to intervene here that could help. Or maybe you make the judgment that I'm going to end up doing more harm than good, and I'm going to just pour gasoline on the fire, and she'll just, you know, take another one for me.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, maybe I should just stay out of it.
Yeah.
But that's a judgment call.
All right, very good. And Connor, thank you so much for your very thoughtful text. Here's a question now from Alexander watching on YouTube this afternoon. A Southern Baptist pastor friend of mine told me that when the Nicene Creed was written, it wasn't yet the Roman Catholic Church. Is that true?
No, that's not true. The Nicene Creed actually references the Catholic Church, the one holy Catholic and apostolic church. It's part of the creed. It's one of the things we confess in the creed. And so the notion of the church as a Catholic unity, Catholic meaning universal, that there's a determinate content to the faith, that there is a determinate form of sacred worship, and that that form is held and professed across the whole world, that is actually a New Testament concept. It originates in the teaching of Jesus when he gave commands to the apostles to make disciples of all nations, not just some of them, not just, you know, the guys over here. And to teach all that he had commanded them, and that he would be with them until the end of the age. Christ, you see, intends, there he expressly commands, a universal aspect to the church and a determinate content, right? All that I've commanded you, make disciples, I'll be with you. And then the early church after Christ in the second century was very conscious of carrying out that divine command. Ignatius of Antioch is the first bishop to use the word Catholic to describe that reality, but the reality itself is something that Jesus explicitly teaches, St. Paul explicitly teaches, and the church was conscious of participating in. So all the theological debates of the second century and great opponents of heresies, like Irenaeus of Lyon, who writes his great book against heresies. Well, you can't really have something defined as heresy unless you have something defined over against it as orthodoxy, you see. So, no, this is completely false.
The Nicene Creed, a product of the Council of Nicaea.
Council of Nicaea, right, 325.
Back in the day. All right. Very good. And thank you so much for your question, Alexander. In a moment, we'll get to the phones, talk with Bill in Dallas, Robbie in Fort Worth. Lots more straight ahead at 833-288-EWTN on Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Hey, glad you could join us for the Wednesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Are you receiving Wings yet? Wings is EWTN's weekly e-newsletter. It's fantastic. Find out about EWTN radio and TV shows, items from our own religious catalog, and so much more. Sign up today for Wings by going to EWTN.com. Just look for the subscribe button. That's all you have to do. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Bill in Dallas, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Hey there, Bill. What's on your mind today, sir?
Well, I've been reading a book. The title is When Jesus Became God, and the Struggle to Define Christianity During the Last Days of Rome. Well, it appears, because of research, that it wasn't until the year 324, when Constantine the Great became the Emperor of Rome, that's when a big fight came over as to whether Jesus was a uniquely holy man or he was indeed God. So it took a long time, and it seems to me that people needed a God. The emperors were always considered God. So it looks like for 300-plus years, Jesus was not considered by Christians to be a God. What say you?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. Is this the book by Richard Rubinstein?
That's the one.
I know it. I've read that one. Yes, I've read a number of these books. Thank you very much. Appreciate the question. So the doctrine that Christ is pre-incarnate divinity can be found in the pages of the New Testament, most clearly in the prologue to the Gospel of John that begins, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And then he goes on to define the nature of the relationship of that divine Word to God the Father, and the Word, of course, becomes incarnate in the person of Jesus. St. Paul also mentions the pre-existence of Christ as God in the famous hymn in Philippians chapter 2, where he says that Christ was in very nature God, but took on the nature of a servant and humbled himself to take on the nature of a servant, being born as a man. So the doctrine of Christ's pre-existent divinity is a New Testament doctrine. Now, it is true that interpreting those passages, what do they mean, how should we square those with monotheism, was a matter of debate in the second and third centuries. And so there are a number of different theories that were floated by theologians to account for how do you have one God, how do you have the Father and the Son being separate persons, and yet confess Jesus as full divinity. And so there were differences of opinion about how to square that. Now, one of the earliest theologians who's very important for the development of Christian theology is Justin Martyr, who died in about the year 165. One of his texts, famous text, is his dialogue with Trypho the Jew. And there's a debate between a Christian and a Jew about the proper understanding of the Old Testament. And I'm actually reading right now from chapter 48. This is very early, much earlier than the Council of Nicaea. And Trypho, who's repeating Justin's position back to him, and he says, "For when you say that this Christ existed as God before the ages..." You, Justin, are saying this Christ existed as God before the ages, and then that he submitted to be born and become a man? And yet, this appears to me to be paradoxical and foolish, see Trypho says. And then Justin responds and says, "I know it seems paradoxical, but nevertheless, this is true. He existed as God before his birth and was incarnate of the Blessed Virgin Mary." So very, very early attestation, and he's just repeating the teaching of St. John in the prologue to his gospel there in, about, say, the 140s, maybe 150s A.D. You can find a version of the doctrine of the Trinity. It's not the fully articulated doctrine we'll find at Nicaea. The word Trinity, a triune God, actually occurs for the first time in the second century in the writings of Tertullian of Carthage, North African theologian. And I could go on to name a number of other theologians who give an account of Christ's divinity. Now, because there were debates about how to explain that, different theories were propounded. So one in particular associated with a man by the name of Sabellius, also called modalism, held, and this was a heretical view, it was condemned, held that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit were simply names that applied to different modes of the one God's activity in the world, you see. So Sabellius wrongly thought that there's only one God, Jesus is fully God, but he's the same person as the Father and the Son. He just kind of puts on a different mask when he shows up at different times. Now, that view was condemned, it was ruled heretical, yet it indicated a strong commitment to the full divinity of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Now, there were other theories that were propounded that also proved problematic. Now, what actually precipitated the Council of Nicaea was yet a different theory propounded by Arius, a presbyter in Alexandria, who said, "Yes, I acknowledge that Jesus is God." He admitted the divinity of Christ, but he thought that Christ's divinity was a participated divinity, that Christ was in fact a creature that existed before the world, so an ancient creature that God had made before all things, but a creature nonetheless. And it was that idea of Christ as a creature, someone that had a beginning in time, that the Council of Nicaea took such exception to, because they said, "You keep using this word God. We do not think you know what it means." Right? And so the Council of Nicaea settled that. But to simply say blanketly that there was no doctrine of Christ's divinity before 325 is just historically inaccurate.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, Bill?
Bill? We lost Bill.
Bill's still there. Did that solve your question, Bill? Okay, got to move on. Bill, we hope that is helpful for you, and thank you so much for your call. And that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Now, two lines open at the moment, 833-288-3986. It's called A Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Robbie is in Fort Worth, Texas, listening on YouTube this afternoon. Robbie, what's on your mind today?
Hello, everybody. I've got a question that bothers me. I like to find the oldest possible books I can on Catholic faith, and I found one called My Catholic Faith from 1952, and it is not very ecumenical at all. And basically, it has an imprimatur on it, and I just wonder why sometimes it seems like in the modern age about the imprimatur to move the goalposts, where don't go to a Protestant service. But now it's like, well, it's okay if you do that. I don't know if the imprimatur was good then, if it's not good now. And I just don't understand some of the things about the imprimatur, I guess. But
yeah.
I have a tangential question, if I could, about a Southern Baptist you called earlier. I had a question about that as well. Could I ask that also?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. The Southern Baptist, very strong person, thinks that Jesus did not descend into hell, and that was taken out supposedly in the Nicene Creed. And she says he did not descend into hell. And I thought, well, yeah, he did, because that's what the Apostles' Creed said. Anyway, I didn't want to ask too, but thank you very much, Dr. Anders. I get so much out of what you say, and thanks, Tom, for getting Dr. Price or Dr. Anders there on TV.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the question. So first of all, the imprimatur is ecclesiastical permission to publish a book, and it's usually also accompanied by the nickel obstat, which means that the text does not offend against anything in Catholic faith or morals.
Okay.
And EWTN, when EWTN publishes, our publishers always seek the imprimatur of the local ordinary, because we want ecclesiastical approval when we put out books. So you can trust anything that comes from EWTN publishers always has that imprimatur. Now, your question: what if the censor librorum seems to move the goalposts with time? Is it possible that a book might not have been approved in an earlier age that would be approved today? And the answer to that question is absolutely yes. Of course, that's the case, and it has to be the case, because in a particular age, let us say that the pastors of the church determine that a particular line of reasoning or area of research might not be safe for the people of God, right? Then they may be circumspect about publishing it, and that's often been the case in history. Now, upon further reflection by the bishops, maybe in an ecumenical council, or maybe from further historical discovery, it is decided, okay, this is really not that much of a problem after all.
Okay.
And so we're going to say okay. Now, any parent who has ever raised a child and sought to exercise some sort of control over the child's media consumption knows this, right? My default position with Hollywood is don't watch it.
Yeah.
That's my default position. Dad, can I see this? No. All right, let me look into it. I'm not so sure about that. Okay, we're a little bit older now. Maybe okay. That's just normal, right?
Sure it
so,
is.
So, yeah,
sure.
An imprimatur is not a declaration that everything in the book is true. That's not what an imprimatur means. It's not the church saying this is the absolute 100% truth, you know, always and for all time. It's just a judgment that it's lawful to print, and doesn't seem to be anything that offends against Catholic faith and morals.
Okay.
So it's a negative criterion. Not really a positive one. Now, on your Southern Baptist friend denying the descent into hell, well, 1 Peter chapter 3 says that Christ went and preached to the spirits that are in prison right after his death, speaking of a post-mortem descent into hell. The way the church has always understood that is that Christ goes to liberate the fathers from the limbus of the fathers as they awaited the coming of the Messiah. The book of Hebrews talks about the ascension of Christ as opening up heaven, making it possible for us to ascend to heaven, implying that the righteous dead of the Old Covenant had not yet been admitted to the beatific vision, had to wait for the coming of Christ.
So we're not talking about the hell of the damned.
Yeah, we're not talking about the hell of the damned, not the hell of the damned.
All right, there you go. Robbie, hope that's helpful for you. Thanks for your kind words about the show. It's called Communion with Dr. David Andrews here on EWTN Radio. We have a line or two open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-EWTN. 888-288-3986. Andy is listening in Ohio on the Great Annunciation Radio. Andy, what's on your mind today?
Just two callers ago, it came up about modalism and then Arianism, and I wanted to know, if Jesus isn't a creature, what does it mean that he is the begotten Son?
Yes, thank you. Appreciate the question. Well, you know, when you recite the Creed is very specific that Christ is begotten, not made. That's what we say, begotten, not made. And that language is very deliberate because what the Creed denies is that Christ had a beginning in time. And so the begetting of Christ is an eternal begetting. We actually say eternally begotten of the Father.
Yeah.
So it is a kind of procession or a kind of emanation, if you will, that would be analogous to the way the conclusion proceeds from the axioms of a geometric proof. You see, there is a relationship there of preeminence, of principle to conclusion, but it's not a temporal relation, right? I mean, the conclusion of a geometric proof, it follows eternally and immediately from the axioms, but it still follows as from a principle. That's the way we talk about the Blessed Trinity. The Father is the principle from which Son and Spirit proceed. They are processions. We talk about the dual processions, right? And the term that we use to describe the procession of the second person from the Father is filiation, i.e. sonship, or in other words, begetting. Now, this is language drawn from human relationships, of course. And every language that we use about God is always analogical. It's not univocal language. So when we say that God begets a son, that does not mean the same thing as when we say that a human person begets a son. Mm-hmm. It is an analogy, and a weak one at that. The disanalogies in our language between God and creatures are always greater than the analogies. But it's the best language that we have, and it sticks very close to the biblical language, because sonship is the language that sacred scripture uses to describe the relationship of the second person to the Father.
Andy, thanks so much for your call. It is called a communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN Radio. Quick question for Sue now. This came via email. Because God is three persons in one God, did all three die on the cross?
No, that is not the case. In fact, there's a fancy theological term for that heresy.
Uh-oh.
It's called patropassionism.
Wow.
Yes. Also, another name for modalism. Patropassionism would be the idea that the Father died on the cross. It just means Father dies, Father suffers, right? No. Only the Son assumes flesh, is incarnate of the Blessed Virgin Mary, and then dies and gives himself as an offering to God the Father.
Do you think a lot of people get that a little bit wrong, or just they don't understand the whole person's idea?
I know that they do. I know that a whole lot of people get that one wrong. In fact, when I was in seminary, I was in the Protestant seminary, and we had to read Millard Erickson's Systematic Theology. He was a Southern Baptist theologian, and when I became Catholic, I did a great library purge, and I tossed a lot of my Protestant systematics. And I regret deeply that I tossed Millard J. Erickson's Systematics, because even though he's not Catholic, I really liked his book. And he has a discussion when he used to teach dogmatics at the Southern Baptist Seminary. He asked students to describe the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity, and he had a student write on an exam, "Well, there really isn't one, because every attempt to define it has been ruled heretical."
Good one.
That's an exaggeration, but a lot of people try to make a mystery intelligible and end up getting in hot water.
Stick with the church. Can't go wrong.
Yep.
All right, appreciate that, and thank you, Sue, for your question. In a moment, we'll go to Stephanie in Houston, Jesse in Waco, Texas, and lots more here on the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Hey, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Why don't we talk about that here on EWTN Radio's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN, if you have that question, comment, something that you really wanted to let us know about, including What is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? 833-288-3986. Let's go to Stephanie as promised. She is in Houston listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Hi, Stephanie. What's on your mind today?
Hi, yes. How are you?
Very well, Stephanie. Thanks for calling.
My question is that how can I convince a non-Catholic that Archangel Miguel is not Jesus?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the question. So the Archangel Michael is only mentioned three times, maybe four, in sacred scripture. Twice, I think, in the book of Daniel, once in Revelation, and once in the book of Jude. And in none of these texts is St. Michael ever identified with Christ. And I think the indications are strong that it can't possibly be Christ or pre-incarnate Jesus,
mm-hmm.
Because the battle that Michael fights with Satan and the angels in Revelation chapter 12 actually facilitates the setting up of the kingdom of the Son of Man and the Messiah. That's explicit in the text. And that same kingdom that's referred to in Daniel chapter 7 is given to the Son of Man character. We read about the Son of Man in chapter 7 of Daniel, who is going to receive dominion, glory, and kingship, where all peoples, nations, and languages would serve him, right? Now, the Son of Man is the messianic title that is applied to Jesus, and that's a different character in Daniel from St. Michael, who shows up in chapter 12. So there's just no textual basis for that claim at all. Now, I know that's associated with the Jehovah's Witnesses, and therefore someone who holds it is not holding that position because of the teaching of the Bible. That's not why they've arrived at it. They've arrived at that position because of the claim of the Jehovah's Witnesses to authoritatively interpret the Bible. So they've received this as something from the tradition of the Jehovah's Witnesses and their claim to interpretive authority. And so I think better than attacking their Christology, their doctrine of Christ, it's better to go straight to the core issue, and that is, does the Watchtower Society, that's the association that governs the Jehovah's Witnesses, does the Watchtower Society possess divine authority to interpret the tradition or to interpret the sacred scriptures? And that's the question I would ask. And if so, who gave it to them? Did Christ ever indicate that the Watchtower Society was the divine authority on which he would build the church and that the gates of hell would never prevail against it? Did he ever teach that? And the answer to that question is no. So they have no claim to divine authority, although they act like they have divine authority. And secondly, how has their historical record been? Has the Watchtower Society done a good job of preserving their community from error? And the answer, again, would be no, because any number of times the Watchtower Society has made predictions about the outcome of future events that have been proved false. Well, you know what the Book of Numbers says about a prophet who predicts something about the future that doesn't come true. You're not to heed to listen to that prophet or the one who claims to be a prophet. So there's no good reason to believe the Watchtower Society and lots of reasons not to.
Stephanie, is that helpful for you?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are most welcome. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio with Dr. David Anders. We are standing by waiting for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you call now, we're probably going to be able to get you on the air on today's program. Here is Jesse now in Waco, Texas, listening also on Guadalupe Radio. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind today?
Our youngest daughter became a Catholic when she married her husband about 21 years ago. Mm-hmm. And my father was raised a Catholic. And but the rest of my family, my mother was Church of Christ, and my wife is Methodist, and I went to Lutheran school. So, but I have been a member of a Masonic lodge for about 48 years now, and my concern is: does that prohibit me from becoming a Catholic?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the question. So having been a member of the Masonic Lodge does not prevent you from becoming a Catholic, but becoming a Catholic would prevent you from continuing as a member of the Masonic Lodge. It would require you to surrender your your lodge membership. The Code of Canon Law of the Catholic Church does not actually permit that. And Canon 1374 has the Masonic Lodge in mind when it writes that a person who joins an association which plots against the Church is to be punished with a just penalty. Now, you might say, well, my lodge doesn't plot against the Church, and so that doesn't apply to me. Well, the Magisterium has interpreted that canon otherwise because the Masonic Lodge has a history, long-standing history, of specifically plotting against the Catholic Church. And sometimes that antagonism has been more overt. Sometimes it's been more, under the radar, so to speak. Maybe you're not even conscious of kind of the average Mason on the street, may not even be aware of that. But that is the history of the organization. It was founded on anti-Catholic premises and actually has a doctrinal statement, and you're familiar with it. When a person becomes a Mason, it's necessary they believe in a God, but they're kind of indifferent as to which one, and that's sort of a big deal, the idea of indifferentism about the identity of the one God. And that's actually the error of indifferentism, and so it's incompatible with the Catholic faith. So both on the basis of their own doctrinal position and on the historical animosity of Masonry towards Catholicism, the Church says it's not really appropriate for members of the faithful to, you know, join an association that has historically been at cross purposes and worked to reduce Catholic influence in civil society.
Scott, or Jesse, rather, thank you so much for your call. Hope that's helpful for you. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Dan in St. Louis says, Dr. Anders, my understanding is that Adam and Eve's sin brought death into the world for humans. However, animals were dying long before this happened, the extinction of dinosaurs, for instance. So death was already a part of God's plan before sin. Can we then say that God created death? And that since God creates only good things, death is good? If so, what does this say about him? That he created a world in which all things were meant to die, except humans, till we sinned? Also, God seems to have demanded sacrificed animals as part of the worship of him, and also to seal covenants with him. Is it fair to say that God somehow found it good for life to be killed on his behalf? Thanks for tackling these questions, Dan in St. Louis.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So obviously, sort of the biological history of, well, the history of biology, history of life on Earth, is something that goes way beyond the scope and intent of the creation accounts in Genesis. Read in context, read sort of with an eye to the author's intent, Genesis 1, 2, and 3 have principally in mind the theological relationship of the human person to God and the question of our moral responsibility and the hope of eternal life. That's really the focus of the sacred text, not really the archaic prehistory of biology as such. Now, if you are interested in pursuing the speculative theological questions about early biology, there's a great source on the website Thomistic Evolution, associated with the Dominican theologian Nicanor Austriaco, that I would recommend to your attention. The way the Catholic Church understands the physical death of Adam and Eve is that immortality was not, if you will, their natural inheritance, but was what we call a preternatural gift. So they had the capacity for immortality, infused knowledge and integrity. That is the triumph of reason over their passions. But again, these things required the intervention of God by a preternatural gift. So, you know, nature as such, being a creature, doesn't have within it a kind of intrinsic necessity that would entail its eternity, its eternal existence. That's something that has to be gifted to it by God. And I think that line of reasoning would be helpful if you think about, say, the dinosaurs or something, did not possess the preternatural gift of immortality the way Adam and Eve did.
Yeah.
I think that there was another aspect of the question. I forgot what that was.
Well, the second aspect was God seems to have demanded sacrificed animals.
Yes, sacrificed animals. So there were actually different perspective I'd like to bring. In the Pentateuch, first five books of Moses, there are specific commands to the Israelites to care for the natural order. So when they besieged a town or a village or something of that sort, for example, in warfare, they were not to cut down all of the fruit trees. When they offered sacrifice, they were never to torture an animal for purposes of sacrifice. It couldn't offer an animal that had died, you know, by having its limbs torn or is, you know, shredded or something of that nature. And in fact, in the Hebrew mentality at the time, the death of the animal involved the loss of something sacred. That life was a gift, understood to be a gift from God, and the shedding of blood was kind of regrettable. And so there were many reasons that Hebrews offered sacrifice, but not the least of which was out of a kind of respect for the life of the animal. So, and in the act of sacrifice, when sin was atoned for through sacrifice, it was never the death of the animal per se that God was pleased with, as if God were some sort of bloodthirsty tyrant who could only be satisfied if he watched creatures suffer. That wasn't the idea. And all of the theology of atonement in the Old Testament really doesn't focus on the death of the animal. It focuses on the gift of the animal. Now, that, you know, death was necessitated in virtue of the fact that all sacrifices were simultaneously barbecues, right? Because they ended in a meal, right? Oh, and so you've got to kill the animal in order to eat it.
Right.
But, you know, the part that God was concerned about was not the killing part, but the giving part. And at times, Israelites could offer things to God that did not entail their physical destruction or death. Offerings of grains and fruits and the so-called wave offering, which is, I think, my favorite.
Yeah.
Wave it around in there. And not killing per se. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to kind of actually regard this death business with sacrifice in a different light.
Okay. Hey, Dan, thank you so much for checking in from St. Louis. Call to Communion here on EWTN Radio. We do have a line open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Hey, be sure to join us for the Catholic Sphere this Sunday afternoon, 2:30 p.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. This week, we're joined by James Day and Jose Miguel, and they'll be discussing the importance of missionary work. Very important program here on EWTN, the Catholic Sphere. Check it out Sunday afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Scott in Michigan, listening on Good Shepherd Radio. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was just wondering if you could tell me what would preclude me from becoming Catholic. Is there a mortal sin, per se, that would prohibit me from becoming a Catholic?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the question. There is absolutely nothing that would preclude you from becoming a Catholic, provided you were willing to separate yourself from any habitual sins that you practiced. And even that doesn't entail that you never sin again. I mean, you're like, none of us would be capable of making that promise.
Yeah.
We simply say, you know, if I've done something wrong, let's say I'm a habitual bank robber, for example. I'm not, by the way, but let's just, for sake of argument, say I were a habitual bank robber, and I went to the priest, and he said, well, are you willing to give up your sins? And I said, no, I think I'm going to hang on to the bank robbery, thank you very much. He said, well, I'm sorry, we can't let you in until you determine to give that up. And I said, okay, I'll give up the bank robbery, I'm sorry, get baptized, come in the church, and then, you know, I'm walking past First National the next Wednesday, and I get kind of weak in the knees, and I have to call a guy to talk me down, and I give in, and I run in and rob the bank. They're not going to kick me out of the church. I just go to confession, you see. So there's nothing that can keep you out other than impenitence, the refusal to give up some habitual sin. But even then, you know, there's an allowance for human weakness and the recognition that in the future, that's what the confessional is for. You fall into that sin again. We have a second plank after baptism to take care of you. Now, it may be, this is just based on what the call screener told me, could be sometimes people find themselves in a marital situation where they're with somebody that they're not validly married to. Right. Well, you know, this, if you're living with somebody that you're not married to, well, that'd be the sin of fornication. And so you got to solve that problem, right? We got to be lawfully married. Now, that can become complicated if a person has been, say, civilly married to several people. You get married, divorced, married, divorced, married, divorced. Then we have a question about, well, who am I actually lawfully married to? Now, again, the church has a procedure for figuring that out. It's called a marriage tribunal. And a lot of times what people find out is maybe they had a couple ex-wives, couple ex-husbands, and the church looks into all of those and says, you know what? We don't think any of these things were real.
Yeah.
We think they were all fake-a-roos, and we're going to give you what's called an annulment. That means a verdict of you're free to go. You know, you can marry anybody you want. You're good to go with the church. So if there's a situation of marriage and remarriage and divorce and remarriage, may need to get the marriage tribunal to look into it. But again, there's nothing that would absolutely preclude anybody from becoming Catholic, except impenitence and lack of faith.
Scott, did that answer your question?
I think it did, and I will go down to St. Joseph's and talk to the priest there in the coming week.
That's exactly what you need to do. Thank you.
Absolutely. Good job there, Scott. Thank you so much for your call. Here's an anonymous email that we received. In response to a question about whether pro-abortion Catholics should be called out by their bishops, you suggested it might upset those Catholics who lean to the political left. Cardinals and bishops only make it worse when they ignore Canon 915. They scandalize Catholics on both the left and the right who hold true to church dogma, such as your questioner whose co-workers pointed out to him the hypocrisy of the Episcopal responses. As St. Augustine said, there is no charity in justice denied. Athanasius said the floor of hell is paved with the skulls of bishops such as these. Any thoughts there, David?
You tell them. Have at them.
Rock on.
Rock on. You know, I don't know that I don't remember specifically saying bishops would make things worse. I mean, the way you phrased it, I can't admit or deny to having said that exactly.
This was several weeks ago.
What I have said many times is, heavens, I'm glad I'm not a bishop.
Yes.
Right. Heavens, I'm glad I'm not a bishop. And you know, it is easy to say, well, you know, we should take a hard line and bishops should stand up and do this and do that and they should excommunicate people left and right. It's easy to say that, all right? It's harder for me to form the judgment, and I know that would have the outcome everybody'd like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times, legislating or executive decision, either by clerics or by civil authorities, can be kind of a form of grandstanding and playing to one's base and this kind of stuff, and, you know, done for acclaim or notoriety, but ends up not actually achieving the ends that I want to achieve. You know, that's always a prudential judgment. So there are a lot of times when the church will refrain from excommunicating somebody, not because they're objectively in the right, not because the sinner is, you know, innocent, but because, like, the bishop judges, and probably prudentially correctly, this is not going to have the curative effect that I want. I'm going to have to try another tack. I mean, in the history of the church, excommunications don't usually work. I mean, just as a matter of fact, they don't often bring about the reconciliation of the sinner. They have, but it's rare. Usually kind of creates a whole other set of headaches. And so bishops always have to make a judgment call about how do I govern the church? It's not an easy thing to do. It's really, really hard. And, you know, bishoprics are not the same. Episcopal dioceses are not the same. They operate in different cultural environments. And they're always having to try to make these calls in real time. We all believe the teaching of the church. We want sinners to repent. We want people to come back in the faith. We want bishops to teach the truth. We'd like politicians to work for justice and the civil order. This is tough to accomplish. And, you know, the Pope stands up and says, don't have transatlantic slavery, which he did.
Yeah.
And Catholics just ran around and had transatlantic slavery all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and Pope says, don't commit abortions. And Catholic politicians say, well, we're going to do what we like. Thank you very much. And how to handle that? What's the best way to actually bring about justice in society and the church and to underscore Catholic teaching is a tough call. I'm glad I'm not a bishop.
You know, you have worked with several bishops here in our diocese in the office of the bishop, the chancery, and you know how tough it is.
So I'm not going to name names and I'm not going to name topics, all right? But I will tell a story,
okay.
All right, that
all
is
right.
Very general because I really have to protect privacy stuff.
Sure,
but I have seen bishops literally stand up and basically scream from the pulpit, we must do X, put their money behind it, advocate for it, write newspaper articles about it, jump up and down and yell about it. And I've seen people in the community say, he just said do not X. Like interpret the exact opposite, right? And it's underscored for me the profound difficulty of governing the church. It's really, I mean, the most well-intentioned bishop fighting as hard as he can for justice and charity and the good of the church and the good of the people can fail to succeed for reasons that have nothing to do with his integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a witness to that from working in a chancery.
Gotta be tough. Thanks so much for that question. Let's go to Marie now. Marie is in New Jersey, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Marie, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I have been married for 44 years. My husband was never baptized. He claimed to be an agnostic when we got married, which he told me was he believed in God but did not believe in organized religion. And 10 years down the road, he told me that he is an atheist. He doesn't believe in God at all. And in these 44 years, we have lived mostly apart. And I'm just wondering, is this something, being that he's an atheist and he was never baptized? We were married in Catholic Church. But is this something I can get an annulment for?
Yes, thank you. I really appreciate the question. So the fact that he is an atheist, and I assume he was an atheist when you got married, and you did get married in the church, the fact that he was an atheist would not itself be grounds for an annulment. However, there is something else you said that could very well catch the attention of a tribunal and be the basis for a declaration of nullity. Not his atheism, but the fact that you said you've spent most of that time living apart.
Yeah.
Okay? And I'm not a canon lawyer, and I'm not on a tribunal. But my understanding is, when they look at that kind of evidence, they're going to say, there was no marriage here.
Mm-hmm.
Not on the basis of his atheism, but because of the actual course of events indicates there just was no commitment to the conjugal union on the part of this individual. And so his vow of lifelong fidelity was disingenuous. And I mean, I have known of such cases. So I think I would pursue it. I would pursue it. And honestly, I would pursue it vigorously. And I wouldn't necessarily take no for an answer. So if first you don't succeed, I would try again. Really, yeah. I think you've got a strong case based on the fact that you haven't cohabitated for a very long time. I think that's really gonna. I know canon lawyers whose eye that would catch. I know for fact that would catch the eye of a number of canonists.
All right, Marie, thank you so much for your call. We're going to close with this one. It is a text that came in. Dr. Anders, what is the Catholic understanding of 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21? To me, it certainly seems to teach that Jesus took the punishment for our sin. Thanks, John.
Yes, thank you. God made him who had no sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Appreciate that. Okay, so many interpreters and some translations render that as God made him who had no sin to be for us a sin offering. Now, a sin offering is a specific form of Levitical sacrifice.
Okay.
And that's exactly what the church has always held, that the death of Christ is a sacrifice offered to God.
Okay. Well, there you go. And we thank you so much for your question, your text question. We do have one more here, and this definitely will close us out. This is from Shirley, who says, I truly believe, and this refers to something that you mentioned on the air maybe two or three weeks ago, Dr. Anders, I truly believe that you are wrong to call the Pius X Society in schism. St. Pius X has Pope Francis's picture hanging in our church, and Pope Benedict even stated they were not in schism.
Any thoughts? I don't think I've said schism. I think I've said disobedience. I know the church doesn't use the schism language about the society anymore. They did at one time. They don't anymore use that language. And in fact, the Pope lifted the excommunications, and Francis actually extended faculties to the priests of the society to validly hear confessions as a kind of solicitude and a condescension to them.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't say schism. I don't think so. If I did, I don't mean to. But it is true that they are in a state of disobedience, and they have no jurisdiction, and they have no lawful ministry in the church. They only have the jurisdiction that the Pope has extraordinarily granted them, which is, you know, very select and very restrictive. And that, again, out of a kind of concession mm-hmm. to their hardness of heart and unwilling to be obedient. So disobedient, yes. Schismatic, that's not the language the church is currently using.
That might be the reason why that picture is hanging in her church. You know, well, thanks. Thanks, Pope Francis, even though we don't agree with all these other things.
I think that'd be a generous interpretation, Bob. Well,
I try to be a generous guy. There you go. Shirley, thank you so much. And we're always glad to talk about that on the air if you want to give us a call. But we do appreciate your email. Hey, Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. And we're glad to do it for you live each and every weekday with an encore at 11 p.m. Eastern, and that's 8 p.m. Pacific. If you want to check out the podcast, it's always available at EWTNradio.net. On behalf of our fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. Looking forward to talking with you tomorrow, Thursday, for EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. God bless.